Daniel, Reel 10. We're talking about the last actions of the South Knot Hussars. I want to ask about Seeley, because Seeley was killed at Knightsbridge, so he undoubtedly was there.
But you I do, but I never saw him. But if, other officers may have seen him, but he didn't come to Birkin's Battery where I was.
You weren't with the RHQ then?
No. There was no RHQ anywhere near me. Walking about on the cauldron was a very dangerous pastime. We were continually getting a deluge of shells, of 88 shells, from the Germans behind their ridge, and they were devastating now shelling, and every shell hit a stony ground and killed somebody.
Were they firing airburst a lot?
No, none. They were all burst on the ground. Well,
so what happened the first day that you remember then? You mentioned you met de Graz. Was that...
De Graz passed me in the afternoon of the second day. He was in his vehicle. It was a 800, I think. And he was being towed by his adjutant. I said, "Where are you going?" And he said, "I'm going to join that large stream of British trucks that you can just see in the distance behind you." I said, "My dear Colonel, those British trucks are full of Germans. They are the 9th German Infantry Regiment and the 164th Infantry Regiment. A German who had lost his way had come into our position, and he had told me what was in those trucks." De Graz said, "I don't believe you, Bob. I think they're all British. They're full of British troops, and I'm going to join them." I saw him go up the hill, and that's the last I saw him.
Now, de Graz had given you orders that you were to stand and fight. What do you remember of that?
De Graz gave me no orders whatsoever. My orders were received over the wireless from the brigade commander. A British tank that had been out of action came past my position on the second night at 11 o'clock in the evening. When it was pitch dark, I stopped it, and I got in touch with my brigade commander through his wireless. And he said, "Bob, you are to stand and fight in the position where you are now. You are not to move. Do you understand me? You are not to move at all anyway." I told him that if I obeyed what he told me, I would lose every single man I had. He replied and said, "You are a hortatory officer, you've been properly brought up, and you know that in battle you will obey orders or take the consequences." I said, "Yes, I knew that perfectly well, but I wanted him to understand that I had a certain number of smoke shells. Now, the smoke shells upset the German tanks very much. They didn't know what was happening because they couldn't see. And I said, I've got enough lorries that are unhurt to remove all wounded and quite a lot of the unwounded to the edge of the escarpment from which we can go down a track, which the tanks cannot go down and cannot come up. There was a German tank on either side of the track." I said, "I will deluge that with smoke and take them through if you give me permission to move." And he, who was the only man who knew, no, I didn't know, he was the only man who knew that there were reinforcements coming up. He naturally said, "No, you stay where you are, and you fight to the last man in the last round." Now, had one of those brigadiers told me who they were, what they were, and what they were going to do, I would have known what we wouldn't have suggested moving. So I said, you will lose every single man you've got. And for a day and a half, spasmodic firing went on all day long, and every single shell killed someone.
Were you aware that there was an ammunition shortage? Because Bill Pringle, who you might remember, one of the captains, the captain in charge of E Troop, 425 Battery, was very worried about the shortage of ammunition. And he says that him and Birkin asked Seeley for permission to try and get out, or to get some ammunition anyway. Were you aware of that shortage of ammunition?
I knew that the guns that had came up without any ammunition at all. And I went to two of the battery commanders and told them that they must send someone immediately back from the direction that they'd come and find their ammunition columns and bring them up. They replied to me, "Our ammunition columns come up automatically to us wherever we are. We never have to send for them." I said, "You are fighting now in a desert. There are no roads. There are nothing to show your men where to come to. And unless you send your men from here to fetch them, you will not get one single round. And I cannot afford to give you any more." That was the answer to that.
But that's not your batteries. Which batteries were they? The batteries from the Indian Division?
Yes.
What about your own batteries?
Well, we had all the ammunition we could carry. We had not any more ammunition, and we had none coming up. I wasn't short of ammunition, but now let me tell you about a 25-pounder gun. A 25-pounder gun has shells on this side. And on this side, it has charges. The gunners put the shell into the breech, ram it home, and then put a charge of cordite in a tin casing into the breech, shut the breech, pull the trigger, and the gun goes off. Now, the Germans had detached from these lorries about an hour rear. A mile or a mile and a half, where the ground had gone up to several tanks, and they were working through the back, and they got down into the cauldron. They were out of sight, but they had come up to the edge of it, and they were firing very cleverly. They were firing at ground level. At each gun position.
Hull down,
unseen. Now, I found one tank was firing at me, and I and a gunner slung a gun round, and we fired five rounds, step along the line that their shell had made on the ground. Whether we hit the tank or not, we never knew. But we never saw the tank. But every single group of charges went on fire from the machine gun fire. So that in the end we had 10 shells, 5 shells, 20 shells, but no charges at all. Now I'm not talking about Barber's battery because I never saw that. That was well down the hill the other side, and I don't think came into action at all. However,
this is 425 battery you're talking about, Peter Birkin's battery.
No, I'm not. I'm talking about Barber.
No, you're saying Barber's battery didn't come into action.
No, it didn't.
Yes, you're talking about.
It was in action, but I mean, I don't think it did anything.
So you're talking about 425 battery, Peter Birkin's battery.
Yes. Yeah. My idea was. He had one gun left.
Hang on a minute, that's right at the end. What now? Could you tell me about how Slynn and Timms were wounded.
Yes, I was sitting in my shell and my slit trench. Birkin was there, Slynn was there, and a shell fell between us. Most of it went into Slynn, and he was mortally wounded in the chest. And he really didn't recover consciousness, I don't think, before he died. He was about the distance you are from me. Well, now, I got tired of sitting in my trench watching people being killed, so I got up and I walked around the position to see if I could find any men alive. I found a guardsman crouching in a trench. In a slit trench. I got him out. I found one of my own South Nazis who had his arm shot off. He had got out, and two other men. And I sent them over to join another guardsman who had come up in an 800 weight and that was towing one of our own anti-tank guns, and he asked me if he could do anything to help. And I said, yes, take the gun. Take these men who are still alive, I can't find any others, and go out there and see if you could stay out there and see if you could hide yourselves and knock out one of the German tanks as they come by. While this was going on, the two Indian infantry battalions, portions of them, came up. Indian infantry. They had a first-class brigade major who had taken charge. All their brigadiers were dead. And he told one infantry regiment to go on the right and one on the left. They went. I don't think they were more than a company each. Anyway, they dug a trench I could watch. I watched them dig it. They had no mines, no wire, and there were no tanks and no guns to support them. And they got down into the trenches, and I knew that in a very short time the German tanks would mop them up, which they did. And there was nothing the men could do. They had nothing to do. They only had rifles. There were Indians. This was our first action. And there was a tank at each end of the trench. And very reluctantly, they got out of the trench and they formed up and marched off from both sides westwards into captivity.
Now, there are a couple more points. Apparently, you fell asleep at one point and woke up. Could you tell me that story to find a staff car next to you? That was on Peter Birkin's position. What happened then exactly?
Just before Peter moved his gun, I was one gunner that I got who was, I went up to him. He was with one of my own guns, South Nazis' guns. And I was terribly tired. I hadn't slept for six nights, and I was absolutely beat. I sat on the ground, and I undid my belt like that and fell asleep. And when I fell asleep, the lanyard of my revolver fell over my head. I suddenly woke up, I think half an hour later, to see a very ancient car in front of me with two German generals in it, a young staff officer and a driver. I had nothing. It goes up like that, and I woke up. I jumped up, and I jumped onto the side of the car.
The running board.
On the running board, and said, you've got to surrender. And I had no arms of any sort, as I could have shot the driver. You see, it had fallen off of my belt. And the staff officer, who was very much alive, leapt across the driver and hit me across the eyes with this map case, knocking me off the running board of the car. By the time I got up and shouted at my gunner to get the gun round and helped him turn the gun round, and we fired two shots at the car, it was going full speed. And although our shots were very close, it didn't get them.
Now, there's two points I want to ask you. People, some of the veterans I've talked to, were telling me that one of them says that you organised a team for one of the guns that the crew had been killed, and he joined in that. He was just a signaller. I mean, were you doing that kind of thing?
Yes. Anybody I could find alive, I brought to help a gun who needed somebody to help him.
And the other thing is that right at the end, they say that you drove up. Now, that doesn't sound right compared to what you've been saying, but that you drove up and you said, form British Square, and pulled out two of Pringle's E-Troop guns to take round to form up on the back of Barber's battery. Now, could you tell me whether that happened?
It actually happened.
Could you explain what you were trying to do, why you were trying to do it, what you were trying to do?
I knew that the guns behind me had no ammunition. I knew that Barber's battery had got ammunition. If I could get guns to it. I tried to get Perkins' gun to it. A German tank had blown it up. So I found these two guns, shouted to them to follow me. I was in my 808 truck, and I started to drive off towards Barber's position.
So let me get through this. So you tried to... So what did you try to do with the first gun? Which one of Peter Birkin's guns?
Yes.
One of the battery.
I told Birkin to do it.
To get a gun across.
Get a gun across.
And he'd done it or not done it?
He had tried to do it, but there was a German tank would slap out on the top of him and blew the gun, and all the gunners, I think, were killed.
Now, so then you tried again.
I tried again with two other
guns. Now, they're supposed to have said form British Square. What was going through your mind there?
If I could get the four guns together, I could face four ways. I could therefore stop any tank and running over them. You must remember I'd seen the tank with Birkin's troop, the German tank, run right over the British gun.
Gary Birkin's troop, 520 battery.
Right, well,
you'd seen that before.
Yes.
So your intent, you did say form British Square.
I don't know.
You don't remember particularly,
no.
But you're not arguing with the idea of it.
No, I'm not. I did try that.
That's exactly what you're trying to do.
Then I got out of my truck because one of the wheels was blown off.
Now, hang on a minute. So you drove up.
Yeah.
And this was according to Captain Pringle, it was his troop, E troop. Now, he felt that, I mean, he may be right or wrong, this is what I'm asking you for. He felt that this broke up 425 battery's position and that they would have been better served staying where they were. What would you say to that?
I would say that I don't know anything about it at all and took no action one way or the other, other than as I told him.
So, your main thing was, what you were doing, could go through this again with you, you were trying to be, the Pringle's troop had run out of ammunition,
yes.
Which is, he agrees with that, so what you were trying to do was to get those vehicles across to where Barber's troop was,
down the hill the other side,
where not only would they be able to form this square, so
right.
to speak, but also they would have ammunition
That's
to fire.
Right. That's what I was trying to do.
Now, do you feel that perhaps, I'm asking you,
yeah.
I'm not, do you feel that perhaps this was a one throw of the dice too many? That people have felt that the resistance was prolonged a bit too far and that nothing was achieved by this?
Never mind. We were told to stand and fight to the last man and the last round, and that's what we did.
So, in your sense, you were carrying out orders you'd been directly
That's
given.
Right, I was directly given, and I had no idea
surrender.
Of surrender at all.
And that would that have been your natural inclination anyway, or was this because you were ordered to do it?
My natural inclination had been to move the whole bloody lot half a day earlier and get them out of trouble.
Well, if you hadn't had the orders to fight to the last round, when the tanks actually were on the position, would you have probably ordered them to surrender without trying to form square?
Certainly not. I never would order anybody to surrender. And no horse artillery gunner officer has ever surrendered.
So although you were ordered not to surrender, that would have been, again, your natural inclination as well. You wouldn't have surrendered anyway.
No, certainly not.
Let
me finish it. Well, one of the wheels of my 800 brake was blown off.
Now, when was that? So
when I was trying to lead these two guns down to Barber's position.
So they tried to limber up, is that right?
I think so. I never saw them again.
You didn't see what happened to them?
No, but I'll tell you why.
You were trying to lead them to Barber's troop.
That's right. I failed because the tanks, German tanks, blew a wheel off my truck.
By machine gun fire or...
I don't know, I didn't see it. I got out of the truck and I walked across to where one of the subalterns I saw, got me Chartres or some name like that.
Now, yes, I can fill that name in for you. It'd be Alan Chadburn.
Yes, Chadburn. I saw him sitting behind a gun in his honey tank.
So the gun was there and he was behind it. Yes. And his honey tank was his OP vehicle.
That's right. Now, behind him were blazing lorries and the place was covered with smoke. It was 5 o'clock. And I knew I had an hour of light to get through before it would be dark. So I personally, machine gun fire was very heavy all round. I rolled into the smoke, but I found I couldn't breathe in it.
So this is the smoke from the burning lorries?
Yes. So I rolled back again, and I was on the way walking across the ground, and the machine gun fire was coming up like hail. I wasn't touched. I walked as far as Chadburn's gun and I saw a German tank about 120 yards away. I shouted to him. He was in his tank. I shouted to him to jump down and help me with a gun. And a gun had appeared from somewhere. He was wounded. He and I swung the gun round and loaded it and I pulled the trigger. And I blew the tank to sky high. It was only 120 yards away. Couldn't miss it. And I then walked back. The gunner had gone. Chadburn, I never saw again.
Now, there are rumours that Chadburn was machine gunned down by the tanks, shouting.
I think so.
Standing on his honey, presumably, shouting defiance. Now, you didn't see that, though?
No. Was behind me.
Now, can I just get this clear? So, you'd left 425 battery, you'd ordered the vehicles to follow you, and then your vehicle was damaged, and you went over to 426 battery, where you were continuing to organise the resistance.
Yes. So I never got to it. I got to the edge of it.
Chadburn's gun.
Chadburn's, there was only one gun there, and one round. I fired that round, one round at the German tank I saw in front of me. I then walked back to my vehicle, which I saw about 40 yards away, and I said to my driver, by this time it was 5:30, there were German infantry from the tanks collecting wounded, and there were knots of Germans fell down everywhere, picking up dead.
Was there any more firing going on?
No, none. And I heard...
Hang on. So, 425 battery, Birkin's battery, which you'd left on the way to 426 battery, were they still resisting when you left?
No. They had only one gun. And that and the gunners had been shot up by the German tank at Blanker point blank range.
So you'd gone on to 426 battery where you saw Chadburn's gun, but that was as far as you got.
As far as I got.
You didn't see the other seven guns?
No.
Now, right, you were talking to your driver.
He said, I've just changed the wheel. And I said, well, thank God for that. And I said, you've got 1 minute to make your mind up. He said, what are you going to do, Colonel? I said, you see those six German tanks that are approaching in line towards this position. I'm going to drive straight for them. And they will be taken by surprise, and they will be unable to swing around that turret to open up with their machine guns. He said, Colonel, you are asking to be killed. I do not want to be killed. I am sorry. We've been together for 3 years, but I'm going to leave you. And he went to the back of the truck and took out his bundle of blankets. And I saw him walk off to join two or three other Germans who were carrying some wounded and surrender. And I jumped in the truck and I did what I said.
Now, hang on a minute. Now, your driver, what was his name? Do you remember his name?
Oh, I saw him again. I'll tell you that later.
He survived.
He survived. He only survived because he got pneumonia. And he was flown over to Italy and didn't go over in either of the two transports that were torpedoed. And I saw him in Piccadilly and he came over here.
Now, the other question is, he called you Colonel, you said. Now, is that a mistake, because you were Major then, or were you given the courtesy title of Colonel?
Not that I know of.
So he would have said Major, where you said Colonel. Yeah, that you were.
Well, I was a Colonel. Oh, I can't remember. I think that...
That doesn't matter.
Mr. Thompson in Cairo said, I promote you here and now to being a Colonel. When he gave me the full field ration.
But that was afterwards. What I mean is, when you were with the South Knots Hussars, you were only Major. You're only listed as Major.
Yes, I'm listed as Major, but I think.
I think you became a colonel afterwards. Yeah, so it's just to check. Now, tell me what happened then. So you got into your vehicle.
And I drove straight for the tanks. Five of them were unable to get their turrets round. One got his turret round and blew off the back of my canopy at the back of the 800 bit. I swung hard left, right round them, and in front of me was a solid line of British 30 hundredweight trucks and eight heavy lorries full of German troops, and they were the 164 German regiment, tank support regiment, and the 77th tank support regiment. They were all standing still, smoking and talking and so on. So I stopped my truck and got out and did the same. But of course they were all clean and I was covered in blood because I had carried a lot of wounded across the position. And I saw a man on a motorcycle in an SS uniform pass me. I saw him drive up to an officer at the front of the column, and the officer said something to him, and he turned around and came back towards me. I got back into my truck.
So they'd spotted you?
He spotted me. I got back into my little 800-weight truck and turned it round and waited for him to come level with me. His revolver, he couldn't get out, nor could I. Mine was stuck with the lanyard on the air cooler. We advanced together. 50 or 60 yards, he was shouting in German, I was shouting in English. I saw I wasn't going to get rid of him, so I made it to knock him off his bike. and he and his pipe fell off. I branched left very hard, but I didn't want to touch his bicycle because I thought it would damage my car and I wouldn't get away. And I drove straight through the German column, took any notice of me, and I moved right through them, and I was away, down towards the Sahara. I thought, well, I've done it. But I didn't realize how very efficient the Germans were. And 50 yards on my right, on the hill, was an emplacement with two 88s, four machine guns, and about 50 men, and sandbags, and they were the flank guard.